This week in Retronauts, everything is lies. Everything is lies! Hello and welcome to Retronauts. We've got a big topic this week. It's more Street Fighter 2. I want to say nonsense this week because, yes, we're not talking about the game itself. We've established this. We know the game is great. We've had multiple episodes, multiple, more than one episode about this fantastic and landmark video game. But today we're diving into the Street Fighter 2 that exists outside of Street Fighter 2. Does that make sense? Because wouldn't you know it, when a game is a hit of that magnitude, everybody wants a piece, and everyone wants to have Street Fighter 2 in their corner. What if we have Street Fighter 2 on a printed page? What if we have Street Fighter 2 on an audio CD? What if we have Street Fighter 2 on the big screen? And I don't mean like a tournament. I mean a big screen version. So today we're going to talk about all those topics. I'm your host this week, Diamond Fight. I am dressed for the occasion. You can't see it, but I'm ready. joining me first in the Pacific time zone.
Hello, it's Shivam Putt, regular Retronauts contributor. I was here on the last Street Fighter episode, which is, I guess, why they brought me back, because I love this game.
Thank you so much, Shivam. Thank you very much for coming back this week. And I believe not the first time on Retronauts, but the first time on this particular topic
is Matt McMuscles from the greatest coast, the East Coast.
See, we can say West Coast, Best Coast, but you have East Coast, Wheat Coast? I don't know. It doesn't
East
work.
East Coast, I'll have you know.
East Coast, Least Coast. Is that what we say?
Damn it. I have no comeback for that.
You know,
the Street Fighter hasn't even talked about yet, and the fisticuffs are already going off.
I left both coasts personally, but I am from New York, so
people, I mean, as they say in Street Fighter, fist will fly at this location.
But yes, we're all here to talk about Street Fighter 2 because I think we're all fans of the game. I think we've established this, although actually Matt, you were not on a previous Street Fighter 2 episode, so maybe you'd like to share quickly what happened to you when your eyes met Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it probably is a similar story to a lot of other people that have spoken on this podcast about in your previous episodes. But I think, like, not even arcade was the first exposure. I think, like, Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo. And I was aware of it as a franchise, and I finally got to see it in the arcades. I think I actually started by playing the Rainbow Edition of the arcade machine, which had all the funny things you could do with the special moves, and it just kind of being like a weird ROM hack. So that was a great introduction. And, you know, just like any kid in the 90s, was there more Street Fighter anywhere else? Were there animated movies? Were there comic books? And I was a huge smelly mark, so I just gobbled it all up, as it were. And less of a fan of the franchise today, as Street Fighter V kind of never really grabbed me, but I'm always on the lookout to see what the franchise is going to do next. And I'm always like ready to be like a hardcore fan of it again. But I love, like, you know, it in general, like, you know, without it, I wouldn't be like a huge fan of fighting games that I am today.
Mm. Absolutely. It's definitely, I think for a lot of people, it was like, that was the entry drug, if you will, the gateway to tapping buttons and punching people safely. But still getting just as angry, you know, inside
exactly.
Your heart.
I mean, you got to slam those keys, man. Otherwise, you don't know how, like, if you don't show the machine you mean it, how does it know that you mean it? Right? Like, if you're not beating the crap out of that standing arcade machine, they will never know. I mean, Street Fighter 1 had those stupid pressure buttons in the first version where you had to pound it hard enough to make Ryu do a fierce rip to the jab. And I'm glad that they got rid of that because poor arcade owners were just getting jobbed by having, like, those machines get basically beaten to death. But
I believe one of the earlier taglines for that version of the arcade machine, like you'd see them in arcades and stuff, like the posters, it would say like arcade operators, like buy the Street Fighter 1 arcade machine, never stop pounding, I believe it was called.
That was the tagline.
Oh, my goodness. Remember that Chuck Tingle? What's going on here?
hurricaned in the butt by my own hurricane.
God. Oh, he should. If he doesn't have, he hasn't written that book, he should. Maybe by the time we've finished recording, he'll have written it already. So, yeah, speaking of Chuck Tingle, yes, let's move on to other mediums because, yes, the games are great. We agree the game and as many variations are great, but there are other things out there. And, well, not all of them are great, but all of them are special and they all deserve our attention in some way or another. And I think the best way to start this with is talk about animation because I feel like that's the
yes.
That's probably the nearest sister, if you will, to an actual video game. It's like, well, what if we just draw the cartoons and the kids watch the cartoons instead of actually playing with these characters? And, you know, I think one of the strong points of Street Fighter II was its appeal, its aesthetic appeal. You know, these characters were very, you know, very well drawn. You know, they didn't have a lot of animation, but, you know, compared to their peers, it was pretty good. And, you know, they have the varied moves and
I mean, the sprites were huge. They were unique. They were easily identifiable from far away. They all had very distinct art styles. And like even for the 90s, when like all the arcade games had to have big, crazy attract things, Street Fighter characters just look cool. For the first time you see Vega climbing up the wall with the claw and the mask, it looks sick. Dalsim floating and looking like every stereotype you've ever heard of. Just like amazing. I mean, these characters had character, for lack of a better word, which is super cheesy to say, but you know what I'm talking about. Like a mile away, you can recognize the silhouette of an M. Bison or a Balrog or something like that. And it makes sense that they would want to capitalize on that as much as possible.
It's funny that you said they want to capitalize on that because as far as I can tell, the first person to capitalize on it had no permission whatsoever. There was a 1992 Korean animated special about an hour long. You can find it on YouTube these days. It's I didn't find it with any subtitles, and I'm afraid I don't speak any Korean, but it appears to be some sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland, but all the people love Street Fighter and they're dressed as Street Fighter characters. I don't know if anyone else has seen this show or not, but...
No, but that sounds like every anime con I went to in the 90s.
Just very, yeah, very goofy, very gag heavy, you know, a lot of, you know, slapping each other. And, but of course, I think what maybe what got the most people's attention was the 1994 animated film produced right here in Japan, produced by Capcom themselves. In fact, a group called Group TAC, unfortunately now bankrupt, but, Group TAC apparently born out of a bunch of ex-Mushi Pro animators, and looking at their history, the only thing that stood out to me was they worked on Touch, the very popular 80s anime, but they took over this project, and Capcom was behind it. The Capcom announced it at a Street Fighter tournament in 1993. It was released theatrically here in Japan in 1994, and I don't think it got... It got an official release in America, but probably I don't think it was only on home media. And even then, depending what version you saw, it may have been dubbed. It may have been heavily edited. I don't know. When did you? I assume everyone here at least has heard of this movie, if not seen it.
Yeah, multiple times.
I have seen the hell out of this movie. So as I recall, I think there was like a theatrical release in like San Francisco or a couple of different places, you know, the very small anime markets, the type of places that would show an Akira in theaters type of thing. But what I remember is being able to go to your Suncoast Video and then they had the PG-13 version and they had the rated R the unrated version. And there was the good version and the one your parents would let you buy. And we all knew which one that was important because there was one scene in that movie, which was the greatest scene of all time if you're a 13-year-old boy in 1994, and that is Chun-Li taking a shower. Let's be real. It was gorgeous. Like, just the art style of this film, first off, even without the weird salaciousness, the art style was absolutely beautiful. It reminded me a lot of the Super Street Fighter II intro sequence of, like, when Ryu and Ken are doing the Hadouken into each other. The story was exactly what you would expect out of a Street Fighter story. They're getting together for reasons and have to fight Shadow Law or whatever. But it felt like it came out of the Ninja Scroll school of animation, kind of like that. It had a very stylized effect. There's a scene where it's weird. I haven't seen this movie since like 1999 or something like that, right? But I remember distinctly there's a scene where Vega goes up to Chun-Li and he's got his claw right on her face. And you see it just kind of like split a little and this blood bead kind of go down her cheek. And it was very, very much evocative. It was very like stylistic and creepy in an amazingly cool way. And this show was just, it was great. As a Street Fighter diehard, I was like, holy crap, this is what I want out of my Street Fighter media. It was so much fun to watch. And like, I mean, I must have watched that damn tape like a dozen times because it was cool. It was really, the fights were incredibly well choreographed. The sequences were really well done. Even the dub was not terrible. It was like par for the course for like, you know, Pioneer era dubs of the time. But man,
yeah,
I like, love that movie.
I remember this being like one of the earliest examples of like, I wouldn't say 100% successfully adapting something. There is no tournament in this movie, which is weird. Right. It's just the characters kind of walking around fighting each other every so often. And there's like a very thin plot with Bison just wanting to collect Street Fighters and get their, like, you know, fighting data and enslave them for Shadow Law, not Shadaloo, but Shadow Law, for whatever reason, decided to call it that. You mentioned the voice acting. Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad plays Fei Long in this movie.
What?
It was one of his earliest roles, and he's just the like English voice actor. And I had seen the English version of this movie like, you know, a dozen times. Like, it's ingrained to me how they say, you know, certain words, and they say everything correctly, which is important. They say Hadouken, and you know, like they couldn't even do that in the major motion picture with Van Damme. They couldn't even do it in like the video game based on that movie. So that stood out to me as a kid watching it. Like, wow, they got all the moves right. And just like in every anime adaptation of a fighting game, the moves are devastating. Like something that takes like 15% of your life bar, it kills you in the anime adaptation. And the last little thing I personally have to say about this movie is that when you watch the Japanese version, it's a very different film. There's completely different musical decisions that are made. Mm. When Ryu and Ken are when there's flashbacks to when they were younger, which is always interesting to me because those are the exact same designs that Capcom used for Street Fighter Alpha.
Yes. Like
long-haired Ken with the ponytail. There's a love ballad that plays in the Japanese version where you can watch it with the lyrics, and it's a love ballad. And it's just Ryu and Ken on screen, so you knew Capcom knew what was up. For the American version, they're like, no, you can't know. You can't have that. That's it's the 90s, you know? So they made sure to replace all that music. You know, when Chun-Li fights Vega, it's like KMFDM.
There's yeah, I know. Korn. It was amazing.
It was really good. And Korn plays in the last scene when the credits start rolling, which is just, you know, Bison's about to, you know, show up against Ryu at the last second. And you just hear, "Are you ready?" And then just Korn starts blasting. You're like, hell yeah.
Okay, look. The Japanese people have a very sensibility for like anime and music and things like that. Like, I mean, the song you were talking about is called "This Love, This Pain, This Strength of Heart," right? Like, that is very melodramatic Japanese, like Dragon Ball Z era music, right? But the American one really understood what the 90s American audience wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, what do I want? I want to see these guys just beating each other with chairs until they die, right? Like, and like, first off, it reminded me a lot of like that same era is where we got the Mortal Kombat movie, which is like the best music video of all time, right? Mm-hmm. For just hard techno music. But the soundtrack for the Street Fighter movie was actually really, really sick. Like, yeah, obviously, good. Like you just mentioned, Korn's Blind, which is an amazing song. Alice in Chains is Them Bones, one of the best bass lines ever for alternative music. KMFDM, which is like one of my secret favorite industrial bands. Silverchair of all people. Come on. But it was just like, yes, they totally shifted the entire movie. However, I don't think it was for a negative. I think that it was rad, actually.
The they're both very valid.
I love them. I love them both.
They're both great. It was only like a couple of years ago I saw the Japanese version when I think Discotech, I think they put out a Blu-ray of
yeah,
that
2016.
Yeah, okay, 2016, I thought that was it. And it was just a very comprehensive disc with, like, anything you could possibly want. And I haven't played it yet, but I even got – I acquired the Sega Saturn version of this movie, which has little bits of gameplay where you play, I believe, as a monitor cyborg, and you have to fight against Ryu. It's like this one sprite that was only made for that game. But oh wait, we can't talk about the games too much. But
that sounds amazing. I've never heard of this.
And it's just like a little thing you do in between watching the movie. You're basically just watching the whole movie, and there's little bits of gameplay interspersed throughout it. I don't have a Japanese Saturn, so sadly I haven't played it, but I've watched some clips on YouTube, and I'm like, this is amazing. I have the disc. I just haven't gotten the chance to experience it yet.
Yes. Well, since you brought it up, yeah, there was, in fact, in Japan only, apparently it was apparently exhibited at E3 one year, but it never came out in any of their nations. It was on PlayStation 1 in 95 and Saturn in 96. And yeah, it's an FMV game based on that movie. So you're watching clips from the movie and you are playing as a cyborg. So you're like analyzing the fights, like looking for combat data or whatever. And the more stuff you pick out and the more stuff you latch onto, like the stronger your character gets, and you get like a password.
What?
So you can save your progress.
Wow.
And then there's basically a one. You can play it like a Street Fighter game. It looks like a Turbo, actually, or Super Turbo. But the only characters are the cyborg and a hologram of Ryu. So you can either fight, you can either play a cyborg and fight computer Ryu, or if you have two players, you can each, I guess you're each cyborgs.
That's
the moves, but basically the move sets are like, yeah, it's like cyborg. It's like moving like Ryu. So it's a,
that's wild.
I guess if I was a kid in Japan, I probably would have run out and bought it right away, because why not? But yeah, looking back on it, I'm like, I don't know how much it's, you know, for an interactive movie, there's not that much interactivity to it, but it looks awesome.
They must have just figured, here's an easy way we can just monetize the movie, since CD systems were like becoming a thing, like the Saturn and the PlayStation. So let's just slap it on a disc. Why not? And, you know, I guess. Well, why not is because I am assuming no one really bought it, and that's why it never came over to.
Well, I mean, think
Japan.
About it. If your choice was, I'm going to buy a DVD of this movie, or I'm going to buy the Sega Saturn version, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, if it's 96, then maybe you don't have a DVD player yet.
Fair. But just, you probably didn't have a Sega Saturn either, though, to be fair.
Well, in Japan, maybe.
Yeah.
It was big here. But actually, I did want to mention that I encountered this way as God intended, in that I was at a Star Trek convention, and it was a fan-subbed bootleg VHS tape being sold, you know, with a third-generation photocopy cover.
Hell yeah.
And I was like, what is this thing? I barely use the internet at this point. What even is this thing? But they made sure to include topless Chun-Li on the cover. So it's like, oh, this is what you're getting. I was like, you got my money, sir.
You know, go where the people are.
Right. But yeah, I mean, when I first saw this, which would have been, you know, pretty close to 94, maybe early 95, you know, I hadn't seen that much anime at that point in my life. So it was a pretty early hook for me. And I was, you know, it was fantastic. It was a fantastic movie. It certainly played into all the stuff that I liked about Street Fighter. You know, it had all the characters recognizable in it, and they, you know, even some of them had very short scenes. I think like Blanka and Zangief, I think, just have one fight and it doesn't really impact the rest of the plot. But they have a big fight and they do all the stuff that they do. And you're like, well, that is definitely Blanka fighting Zangief. And, you know, that's what I wanted to see. So, you know, it wasn't until, yeah, years later when I think I was working in Suncoast and I saw the regular version on the shelf, and I saw the, you know, had the big sticker on it saying, you know, featuring songs by Korn and KMFDM. I was like, that's not the version that I have. Okay. But yeah, I really appreciate how much work went into that movie. You know, you mentioned the Chun-Li Vega fight scene in particular is just, there is so much attention to detail in every action. I mean, I think a lot of it, let's be real, there's at least some, you know, 20-25% horniness at work here, because
yes,
Chun-Li is barely dressed. So every move that she does, you can sort of like, you see her shirt flop up and you can see her underwear or her bra sometimes.
Look, it was really detailed animation, okay?
Right. But she's still kicking, you know, she's still kicking the shit out of this guy and he's trying to kill her. And like, it's, you can, like, it's a really serious scene, but it's also cheesecake. And in any case, they, you know, went all out.
The fight, like I said in the beginning, the fight choreography in this was fantastic. Even though, yes, it was a very serious, like, Vega is trying to assassinate her. Bad things are happening. She is completely caught off guard. She is, like, basically naked right out of the shower, like, wearing just, like, a, you know, sweater or something. But the fight scene is real. It's got real heft to it. It's got, like, the building is destructing. Like, I feel like if they were to take that stage today and put it into a fighting game, it would be sick. It would just be completely, like, mayhem and, like, I mean, it really, it added a lot of gravitas to what is just otherwise, you know, Vega versus Chun-Li, a very common fight you'd see. And I thought it was really cool to have the two airborne characters fighting each other, because then you get, like, you know, all the kicks.
She's jumping off the walls.
Oh, my God. And the animators really cared and put a lot of care and concern into making sure that there was fidelity between the video game and the animation, because it's hard to make real humans move like video game characters. And in animation, where you're trying to make real, kind of realistic looking people, getting them to jump off a wall into a, like, spinning bird kick is not an easy task to do. And yet they managed to pull it off in a way that was just like edge of your seat, like, holy crap. You know, it was really, really good.
And why that scene stands out as well, like, in addition to everything you just said, is because, like, aside from the very first, like, opening intro fight with Ryu and Sagat, the movie is actually quite slow up until the Chun-Li and Vega fight. It's just characters kind of just talking, you know, the plot's slowly unveiling. And that, when that scene happens, and Guile's also trying to, like, you know, get to Chun-Li's apartment because, you know, something's wrong, there is this, like, sudden burst of, like, tension and forward momentum. And then, like, after that, the movie kind of, like, takes off from then on. It's a series of things that are just ramping up and you know, leading up to the climax. And I, like, that's why, like, if you mention this movie to anybody today, they'll say, yes, I remember Chun-Li's shower scene, but they'll also be, the fight is really awesome too. And
you're absolutely right. I think the rest of the fights in the show are maybe less than great. I mean, they're good,
yeah,
but they're nothing good. That was definitely the set piece, centerpiece of the movie. I think Ryu versus Fei Long was also really cool.
That was really good too. I remember rewinding that scene a bunch of times because I was trying to pick out all the special moves. Like, Fei Long does his dragon kick, but there's a little bit of flame, and I'm kind of like, oh, that looks a little, I need to rewind and make sure that he did it because I love that move so much. So the movie is filled with that type of stuff. And in the Van Damme film, like, you blink and you'll miss it. They kind of do an homage to a special move every so often, but they're really half-hearted attempts.
In the Van Damme movie, they kind of, like, it's like homeopathic Street Fighter. You know, it's like they kind of wave a super move in the corner and you're like, okay, bro, really? But at least in the animated one, like, for instance, in the Ryu of Fei Long fight, when Ryu does a combo, right? He does fierce into strong into his roundhouse kick, and you can actually see the way that they're chaining it together that you have to be a real Street Fighter nerd to understand that, like, you know, the target combo he just did. But it's visible. He does, you know, left punch, right punch, and then kick, and it's like, oh, somebody played Street Fighter when making this movie. Unlike the Van Damme one, somebody actually knew what Street Fighter was.
Right. You know, you mentioned the Alpha influence, and yeah, absolutely. This game directly influenced the creation of Alpha, which debuted in 95. And I believe it's Alpha 2 that actually has the sort of grassy scene the opening bout of Ryu versus Sagat.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that I think that's the most direct reference, at least to, although I guess you have the in Alpha, there's also the dramatic battle where you can play as Ryu and Ken fighting Bison 2-on-1.
One of the coolest things of all time.
Yeah. There's no Truck, though.
Truck should have been a playable character.
Someone's got that in Mugen by now, I'm sure.
Man, it's so much better than the Street Fighter American cartoon that was released around that time, though.
What are you talking about?
The one which had, like,
No, I mean, like, you're wrong. What are you talking about? It's not nearly as good as that.
It was so bad.
Let's talk about that, because yes, the after the animated film in Japan, which was 94, a lot of the same studio and directors, they worked on a series which is confusingly titled Street Fighter 2 V. It's very hard to Google now because, of course, Street Fighter V means Street Fighter 5 now. But yeah, I remember also seeing in Suncoast there were VHS copies of Street Fighter 2 V. Unfortunately, I never actually watched that show, but I know it continues a lot of things from the movie. Did anyone else see that series? Or
it does, but it doesn't, because it also is kind of like a reboot where Ken and Ryu are just a little bit younger and they meet characters for the first time. Like, they'll meet Guile and meet Chun-Li. I don't have a whole lot to say about V. I think it's because V stands for victory, if my memory serves. But I remember renting the first VHS tape that had, like, I don't know, three or four episodes on it. And I remember as a kid not really liking it because they did change quite a few things. Like, Ryu and Ken are very jokey with each other. Like, Ryu is not that dissimilar from Ken. He's kind of like, yeah, let's party, let's do some things, let's go and drink. And I was, as a kid, I was like, okay. And they meet characters in this weird way. There's still no tournament. Charlie from Street Fighter Alpha's in it. I believe he's just called Nash. He's got a beard and he's got brown hair. And as a kid, I just remember thinking, this isn't Street Fighter. This is some other anime. Well, back then I didn't know what anime was, so I just went by the marketing term, which was Japanimation. And I was like, this Japanimation must be some different series. And they called it Street Fighter. That was my overlying thought.
It was the Robotech of anime, right? The problem was that Street Fighter 2 V, because I remember when it came out, because obviously at that time I was a hardcore Street Fighter nerd, and I watched it for like 10 minutes and I was like, the character designs felt off model. The character designs felt off model. The storyline was kind of vaguely Alpha 2-ish. And I was like expecting the movie, which was like sleek and like mature and cool. And this felt more like a cartoon, you know, like, if you can understand the connotation I'm lending to that word, right? Like, it felt more aged down for kids. It felt more like cheesy, and it was just not as cool. It was not nearly as cool. And you could tell that the budget was much lower than it was for the movie. Cammy looked hella weird. Dalsim looked hella weird.
Yeah.
Guile had a fat chin and a tiny haircut, and I don't know what was going on with that. And it was just not, it's not a good time. Like, I didn't spend very much time with Street Fighter 2 V at all. I was like, I'm just going to go back and watch the movie again.
I wouldn't mind watching it again and just seeing if you know, I can appreciate it a bit better. Because
yeah, like,
if you
now
go back and watch these things, you can kind of laugh or be entertained by them. But I remember at the time just being, like, disappointed with it. But this is like, yeah, this is like 97 or something. I might have watched it. And that's the time where you're at that age where you get really, really angry if the thing is not exactly like the thing that you want. If a character behaves differently or a move is different, you're like, no. But now I'm like, I don't nearly care like as much. Like, I want to see silly differences, which is why I like the USA animated cartoon so much. God. Because it's so stupid and because it's so wrong.
The USA cartoon looks like if you went to a Chinese toy factory in Shenzhen and got like knockoff versions of Street Fighter toys that were made out of like melting plastic, or like they just, you know, repainted old like Transformers or something and put it into a TV show. That's what it would look like.
Whoa, slow down, Rockefeller. It's not nearly that good. You have to go into the dumpster behind that factory and get like the reject toys that they threw out.
It's so garbage. Oh my God. It was so horrifically bad. And just Guile looks so stupid. He's, of course, because he's a white American guy, he's the hero of the show. And it's the dumbest thing I think has ever been put on air for like a video game knockoff. And that is a low bar to cross.
Well, let's talk about the cartoon just a little bit. So yeah, the American show, which debuted on USA, it appeared in 1995. So it's after the live action film. And yes, Guile is the main character. And he is the leader of a squad of heroes, and they're fighting against Bison and his evil team. And honestly, I guess each episode, I think they do whatever the hell they want. Honestly,
it's freeing. It's a show that's absolutely free. It doesn't have to be beholden by rules and lore and all that silly stuff. It's actually a sequel to the Van Damme movie. Like, it talks about that film, like it happened in the past, which was always kind of interesting to me. And like Ryu and Ken are like gun hustlers. Like, they're always, they're trying to get like scams going. Ken really is, which never made sense to me as a kid, because Ken is rich. He doesn't need to do this. So he's just a spiteful human being at that point. And there's so much to talk about this show. I know we can't spend forever, but like, I've based most of my personality on this show. It's like half of my career on the internet is all about making fun of this show. I do a monthly watch along of every episode on my Patreon. Go check it out. The only thing I really want to say is that they do throw some curveballs that are really fun. Sakura gets introduced in the show as like a character. There's an episode all about Final Fight where they go to Metro City.
Yeah, wasn't Mike Hagger in the show somehow?
He's in it for about 3 seconds. It's Cody is this hot-headed meathead that's just like, where's my Jessica? They rewrite the Final Fight story so that Ryu and Ken are the heroes. If that makes any sense.
I would play Final Fight with Ryu and Ken.
I would too. And the last thing is that Akuma actually appears in 2 episodes. He has one where he just kind of fights Bison and Guile, and they have to team up to fight him. And the other one, which is actually pretty interesting, it's probably one of the better episodes of the entire show, is that it's a story about Ryu and Ken fighting Akuma, and Gouken is introduced for, I believe, the first time, like, in terms of seeing him physically in any sort of medium. Because remember, this is like 95, 96. So, and you see him, and he's pretty accurate to what Gouken would look like when he was introduced in Street Fighter 4. He has a similar beard. There's some differences in his color palette, whatever.
I am aghast that the first time they introduced Gouken in canon is from this friggin' pile of a TV show.
And he's not called Shen Long, right? He's not called by that, like, you know, mistranslation. So someone that was working on this TV show asked Capcom Japan directly, what the hell is the name of this character?
That is wild.
Because they really wanted to capitalize on that, like, who is Ryu and Ken's master. So most of the show is like, yeah, it's fluff garbage. But there's a couple of gems in there where they do one all about Ryu and Sagat's rivalry. It doesn't have all the other G.I. Joe crap in it. So I'd say there's like 5 or 6 episodes that are like really neat, like curios, whereas like the other 20 episodes are kind of like take it or leave it.
That's wild.
As you said, yes, there were, in fact, there's only 2 13-episode seasons. So there's not that much of this cartoon to go around. But it apparently – the viewers that found it, they must have stuck with it, because there is so much information on the internet about this show. It must have touched so many lives.
It sure did for me.
I love what it says in the Wikipedia, though. Despite lasting 2 seasons, the same amount as Mortal Kombat Defenders of the Realm and Darkstalkers combined, Street Fighter has suffered from a predominantly negative reception. No kidding, but it's a complete trash heap. The animation was sub-Captain Planet, the story was contrived, and the dialogue was wretched. Yes. Yes, Wikipedia. Yes.
It's funny that Captain Planet came up, because in looking into the creative staff, it was very interesting to me that I couldn't find, like, if you look at Wikipedia and, like, the list of creators, like, the first season seems to have, like, 3 or 4 different people behind it, but the second season seems dominated by one name. I looked at this guy, Will Minio. And he is a veteran cartoon man. He worked on Captain Planet. He worked on Batman. He worked on the X-Men show. He worked on a later – not the 89 version, but the later Turtles show. He worked on G.I. Joe. He worked on a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And his name is all over the second season. So I wonder if somehow maybe someone started the show and – then they had – maybe they brought someone in for the second season to sort of try to
– fix it.
Give it more direction. Like, the first season's kind of all, you know – a mixed bag of names. The second season, like, he's a credited writer, or at least story writer, on most of the episodes. And you also have credits from other, like, established comic writers, like Len Wein, Marv Wolfman, like people who, like, you know,
okay, they were. So, they, I need to aside for a second. When you said that name, Will Mignot, that triggered something in my head. I'm like, I've heard that name before. And okay. I was like, why would I have heard this name? Because the other thing I'm known for is being one of the world's biggest Dragonlance fan. Dragonlance, of course, a D&D setting and a book series and whatnot. And Dragonlance had an animated movie that was put out in 2007-8 or something like that. It's starring who the hell was that guy from 24 who was angry all the time?
Jack Bauer?
Yes, Jack Bauer guy. He was playing Raceland, the main character. But this was a really horrific animation series, a movie that had terrible animation. And I mean, I knew all the cast because I was a hardcore fanboy. And it was written and created by Will Mignot, who went and got the license and made the anime version of Dragonlance. So great. Thanks, Will. You have destroyed two of my favorite franchises of all time. Please touch no more.
I have to get this in there. When I was making like kind of YouTube poop videos based on this cartoon, I would just show the highlights and all the stupid stuff, make my own edits, whatever. Capcom community, the Capcom Unity site, back then Seth Killian worked for Capcom, and he thought these videos that I cut up were so funny that when they're recording the voiceover and cutscene lines for like the rival fights in Street Fighter 4, he tried to get a note to the voice casting director for Guile to yell "Bison!" exactly like he does in this cartoon, because in the very first episode, if anyone has not seen this cartoon, just watch the first episode and you'll get exactly what it's doing, where it's so over the top and silly that when someone just tells Guile that Bison is doing something, he raises his fist to the sky and screams "Bison!" And then a fire of unknown origin bursts from behind him and he screams out "Bison!" Seth Killian tried his best. He's like, hey, I told the voice acting director, I love this old dumb cartoon. Make sure that the guy playing Guile says "Bison" in this way. And then he got back to me and he's like, yeah, they didn't really do it. So in Street Fighter 4, he just kind of goes "Bison," you know, and I was mortified. I was like, oh, that would have been so sick. But they could have at least gotten Bison's like, yes, yes, in there. But sadly, no.
God damn, this show is so bad.
We've spent the most time talking about it.
Well, it's funny, you know, and that show definitely kept the idea that Blanca was Charlie,
yeah.
Like those, which was, you know, teased in the movie, and the show kept that up. And, you know, Capcom absolutely does not want that to be real.
Not at all.
Because, you know, they actually brought Charlie back from the dead in 5. Like, I don't know. He's got a half robot face.
Yeah, he's like Cyborg Charlie.
Yeah. So it's funny how there's two very different ideas about who Charlie is and who Blanca is.
And in the games, Blanca's very comedic relief, like as the games go on, like in the Alpha series and later, he's just kind of like, I'm a goofy monster, blah, blah, blah. And in this show, even though the Alpha series was starting up, like when Blanca was added in Alpha 3, they did something very like they try to make him into Frankenstein's monster in this show. It's always like, oh, woe is me. And like, oh, her, Bison, I knew him well. And like, he's always grappling with man versus beast, like every single episode. And they go back to that well over and over and over. And whenever there's a Blanca heavy episode, I just kind of tune out. I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. It sucks being a monster. Boo hoo.
But I think that's plenty on the extrable animation.
I can keep going. You better move on, though.
We should move from the animation to the extrable comic books that were put out.
Yes, I think it's time to transform to the printed page. And as before, you know, there was a Japanese version first. There was, in fact, a manga produced in Japan starting as early as 1983. Apparently, in Japan, the title was Street Fighter II Ryu. And I guess he, you know, focusing on his story. which actually was released, like commercially released, probably, I think it was Viz. I'm not sure it's Viz or Mangatainment, but it did get an official release. Unfortunately, I have not read that one. Did anyone?
I never saw it. I think that was before I started getting weeby, so I probably didn't get it.
That's all right, because there sure was an American comic. It was produced by Malibu Comics, and correct if I'm wrong, Malibu, they seem to do a lot of like commercial tie-in stuff. Like they did Mortal Kombat, I think, as well.
Malibu, yeah, they did.
It's funny because Malibu was founded by one of my friends, actually, for who I know through Magic the Gathering, which is not at all related to Street Fighter. But yeah, like Malibu was a weird like comics place that basically did a lot of third-rate comics that came out. It felt like just a whole bunch of like, I mean, they did a lot of like comics that other companies wouldn't touch. It was kind of a weird indie, like other brands type of things. Like they didn't have their mutant. I mean, they didn't have like, you know, the X-Men. They had like
the Ferret.
Yeah. Like, you know, the Protectors or
the
whatever.
Honey Badger.
I mean, they were making comics out of Sherlock Holmes and Tarzan, which I'm sure were great hits in 1994. And the X-Mutants and other, you know, like other things that were just like, it felt definitely like a step down from ye olde Marvels and DCs. Which is funny because Marvel eventually bought them and then canceled like everything they had. But the thing is, they got somehow the Street Fighter license. And I had the first three of these comics before it was canceled. And I remember very little about it, except they looked horrifically bad, like horrifically bad. Balrog looked like a 60-year-old ex-fighter who's just like, you know, on his last legs and just fighting because he desperately needs to pay the rent. And it was just bad.
It's not great. I have the trade paperback, and I've been trying to think of some way to monetize this, make a video series about. I don't know. I haven't cracked the code yet. But the opening like first page is instantly problematic because Ryu's fighting Chun-Li, and he's just like, Chun-Li, you'll never beat me due to your vagina. Like he's just like. It is written like a 90s comic to a T, where he's just like, you're a woman. You can never possibly be better than me. And then they flirt, and it's just really creepy. It's implied. It's never resolved because guess what? Capcom canceled this after three issues. In the trade paperback, there's a page that has the creators of this comic. It has this salty rant. Oh,
the letter. I will never forget. Okay, so this letter, mind you, listener, I do not have the comic in front of me. However, to this day, like almost 30 years after I read this piece of dreck, I can still remember how salty these guys were in this letter. Because they sat and they read like, well, our license has been pulled by Capcom. We were going to introduce all sorts of new characters. I was going to have the first Street Fighter that had a weapon, and she was going to be awesome. And these guys totally – I mean, it was just the saddest – like, it felt like a fanfic writer just like, completely just sent off the internet, just being like, they wouldn't let me write my story. I'm like, oh, my God, just stop forever, please.
We should probably break down, because the first issue, you know, yes, absolutely, there is this, the Ryu and Chun-Li stuff is very strange to me. Like, why are they even, like, why are they suggesting relationship at all?
Yeah.
But oh, God, dude.
Some of it is at least on brand, and that Sagat is clearly angry about Ryu like beating him in the past, and he wants to get revenge. And he's teamed, you know, he's working with Bison, he's working with Vega. Not Vega, sorry, I'm confusing the English and Japanese names. He's working with Bison the boxer. He's working with Bison the dictator, and he's working with Balrog the boxer. And you know, he's got this plan to get revenge on Ryu. So he's, you know, and they're like, oh, well, you can get revenge on him by fighting Ken. And
okay.
Yeah, Ken is now like a Johnny Cage. Like he makes movies and he's like an action movie star. So they like sort of ambush him, and they're fighting him literally in a street. They're literally just fighting in the street. And like it's sort of like it's a little too violent, but it is like they are fighting and they're doing the things that, you know, they literally shout fireball like when he throws a fireball or dragon punch. But at least you can see where they were going with this. But then in issue two, they defeat Ken, and apparently they kill him. They murder him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And send his scalp in a box to you in the mail? Like, but in a car?
It's like, the best.
It is. It is. And you look at this and you can just imagine the execs of Japan, of Capcom Japan, looking at this book going like, no, never, not in a million years. Get the hell out. You're lucky we didn't sue you.
If Street Fighter VI has a trailer that shows Ryu getting Ken's scalp in the mail, I'll pre-order. That's amazing.
Oh my god, dude. But it's just, it's so messed up. Like,
it was never resolved either. Like, it got canceled before they could even reveal if Ken was alive, I think.
The ending tirade where they sort of recap what they wanted to do with the story, they insisted that Ken was gonna prove out he's not dead, but he is bald. Because he got scalped, and that's what happens when you're scalped. You lose all your hair, not your skin.
And it's like, okay, I guess that's, what the hell is it? I mean, like, you've got, like, Saget is just standing here holding Ken by the hair with a gigantic knife in his hand, and like, what, why, what happened?
Yeah, and then the third issue, yeah, it, somehow the ferret appears and he starts training with Honda.
Oh yeah, Honda butt crunches onto his feet.
Yeah, it is. You can feel like, yeah, issue one is like, yeah, this isn't very good, but at least I see you did your homework at least. And yeah, issue two is like, no,
it's what you'd expect at right. the time if it was like a lower class company, like there wasn't Marvel or DC was making it. But if they try to shoehorn the ferret in there to try to like, oh, Street Fighter's way more popular than anything we'll ever make, but we can get kids hooked on the ferret if we shove him in there against Honda, it's like real desperate, feeling.
It was bad.
And Shang Long is there by name, but he's being poisoned by this new character they wanted to make. You know, like, I think her name is Nida or Nida. I don't know how to pronounce it, but that was one of the new characters they wanted to introduce. I mean, good on them for making another woman in the game, at least, but still it was the comic, but
yeah,
it's an ugly thing.
Like the Malibu Mortal Kombat comics, from what I remember, there were lots of them. Like, that was a success, and whatever team that they had doing the Mortal Kombat ones, like, at least got somewhere. Like, there are multiple spin-off series. Like, there was like a Goro like mini like series, and like they at least Malibu did okay there. But the Street Fighter one, like, it was. I think they needed to wait maybe like a few more years, like maybe 96, 97 to really get that out there and have a team that kind of understood. Because if they made it as fast as they did, it's like they didn't really understand the characters quite yet because they hadn't been fleshed out with more like official like adaptations like the animated movie. What year did you say it was, the Malibu comic?
93. So it predated that film.
So yeah, it predates it. Of course, that makes more sense now. Like like we don't understand that Ryu is not really like this. But if you just played like the first Street Fighter, you might not know. Like,
maybe well, you got anything. No story to go with. You just know this guy's a loner who likes to fight in waterfalls, right? Like, Street Fighter 2 did not have much in the way of plot. Like, so if you're just gonna make up fanfic based on it, I guess fine. But make him into a weird MRA that's trying to just like, I don't know, like, beat Chun-Li into loving him is the dumbest thing you could possibly open a comic book with. Because even if you know nothing about Street Fighter, but Ryu is like a loner who likes to fight, that in itself is not a guy who's going to be like, oh, Chun-Li, once you were like the rushing river, and now you are like this oak that is immobile, and you have given up the fight. Oh, here, let me just read to you Ryu dialogue.
Okay. Dramatic reading time.
We agreed that we are together to train. You are more beautiful than ever, Chun-Li, but you have changed these past months. Changed? What do you mean? Once you were like this stream, laughing, flowing around life. Now you are like this tree, strong, flexible, yet rooted in your obsession. Your quest for revenge against M. Bison has made you a different person. What? Are you saying that I am unjustified? He murdered my father. I will have justice. You don't know that. You don't have evidence. Not yet, but I've been doing more than improving my martial arts. I joined Interpol. Oh, for Christ's sake, stop. Just kill me. Just kill me.
Ryu just gaslighting her. Like,
yeah, and Ryu, like,
allegedly Bison killed your father.
And Ryu's answer is like, what are you saying? You abandoned the way of the warrior for the common police force.
No, you said ACAB.
Oh my god, yeah, dude, he's like straight up just like, what is this garbage? And then she just gut punches him, and that's really what he deserved.
No, that's the thing. So Chun-Li fighting for revenge against her father, that is in Street Fighter 2, but is her being a police officer being Street Fighter 2?
Yes.
It is? Is that part of the ending?
Yes. That's her story arc.
Just the police force, I think.
She's in like the Hong Kong police force. She's working with international agents. All of that Street Fighter canon. It's always been. Like, her ending sequence is like, now she is, you know, finally freed and like, she is like, avenged her father's death and she can go off and be a cop and stuff like that. Yeah, that's all part of the story. So that's like the few parts that were actually correct. Oh God, these guys are just so, this comic was horrible. Horrible.
You really have to, respect them. You don't respect them at all, but you have to respect their naked appeal to fans in that as part of this lengthy, you know, epilogue where they want to, here's all the ideas we wanted to include. They literally include Capcom USA's address, phone number, and fax number.
For all 12
as
people.
As if like, yeah, go get them.
Yeah, it's for all 12 people who read this to be able to go and say, we want Ferret.
More add Ferret to Street Fighter 3.
Yeah, we'll get right on it, buddy. Oh, God.
So I think we can move on from animation and comics to music, because at least one of these things is very interesting to me personally. At least in Japan, Capcom started making Street Fighter albums right away. The first album came out in March of 91.
What?
So, yeah, at that point, you know, Street Fighter 2 is still very new in arcades. And it's actually the album's name is Street Fighter 2 GSM Capcom 4. And it has like arranged medleys of Street Fighter 2 music, but also Magic Sword and Final Fight and games I've never heard of. Cheeky Cheeky Boys? I don't even know what that game is, I'll be honest.
How could you not have heard of Cheeky Cheeky Boys? It was the hit of 1987.
But there are arranged medleys for each of those games, and then it just has all the original music. So if you went to the arcades and you were really into Street Fighter 2, this was your first chance to get that music, you know, and play it at home. And then months later, they released a second album, which is very common. They called the Image Album, Street Fighter 2 Image Album. And that's a full Street Fighter 2 soundtrack of all arranged tracks. So that's like, you know, I want to hear the music, but I don't want to hear the chip tunes. I want to hear like real instruments. So that's what that delivers to you. But for me, what's always going to be closest to my heart is Nesho Street Fighter 2. Now, Nesho is a Japanese word, which is sort of means like passionate singing, like hot-blooded, sort of, if you think of, you know, the Kunio-kun is like hot-blooded, like sort of hot-blooded songs. So Nesho Street Fighter 2 came out in 1992. These are arrangements of Street Fighter 2 music, but these songs all have lyrics and they're sung mostly in the first person. So this is a song where this is an album where you get to hear each character sing a song about themselves to the tune of the music that you've heard in the game.
Uh-huh.
And it is, I feel like magic. I think magic is the best word to describe
it's an experience is what you're saying.
Yes. Now, obviously, this is produced in Japan, so almost all these songs are in Japanese, even for the characters who are not Japanese themselves. Like, the Zangief song is really weird because it's sung in Osaka Ben, like the local dialect, and he's like, I guess he's coming to Osaka, and he's going to, like, spin around a lot because of his, you know, pile driver. But yeah. The Blanca song, because Blanca doesn't talk. Blanca's song is all about Blanca coming to Tokyo. So people are singing about Blanca, but Blanca does all his roars. So the people who are roaring in response to Blanca, and it's got game audio. So like the Blanca audio is in the game of him roaring. And then you've got this, like, must be a room full of men going back at Blanca. It is
so much dedication here to like the characters.
Yes. But the two songs that stand out to me the most, one of them is, you know, Boxer. Bison is the boxer in this one, cause it's Japan. That song is in English. So you've got an entire song about the boxer singing about how he's going to punch his way around the world. and he's going to, you know, he's going to punch his way towards victory and he's going to live his dream. I think the song was called Bison's Dream. And it's him, you know, singing about his goals and aspirations, you know, as being a boxer.
This is very inspirational. I hope he's thriving wherever he is.
And I love Japan.
Lastly, you've got the Vega song, Dictator song, which is called Silent Gravestone. And this one has no words. It's just grunts and groans and sort of snickering sounds all to the background music. And it is, for me, I first found this when I was into the Mugen scene. And I put this song as a background stage to one of the weirdest Mugen characters I ever saw that was sort of this half humid like blob. And so if you were to be fought him, you just had this sort of grunting, you know, grunting bison laugh in the background.
Did they just run out of ideas for him or like,
I don't know. Maybe it was like the idea was that, oh, well, you know, if everyone else is singing about their passions, then this is, he's evil. So he can't sing a song about what he wants. He's just going
to, I mean, I would love to have a bison like song about him wrapping cakes for Christmas or something,
more like stealing cakes,
his side job in a bakery. God, dude, Japan and like doing weird soundtracks for things is just one of the great, like, it's so weird because when you're a fan of like a Japanese property and you go and start looking for music, you will see things like random, like Phoenix Wright jazz arrangements or whatever. And it's like, I love this. Why does this exist? I don't know, but I love it. Yeah. But like sometimes they go a little overboard with these like weird vocal albums and you're like, who wanted this? And who is passionate enough to put this together and then sell it? And you're like, well, Japan, here we go. And now they're like $12,000 on like eBay or something.
Well, I should stress, Nesho, as all these albums I've mentioned, you can just find this on YouTube now and listen to it. So I do encourage everyone at the very least, look up Bison's Dream, because that is in English. So you can enjoy his, you know, his spirited wishes.
It's probably better than reading the Malibu comic. That's for sure.
Probably.
Yes, so it's. I think it's high time we talk about the live action productions.
Yes,
which took. It's funny. In the one hand, it took a little longer, but at the same time, it didn't, because as early as 1993, you had Hong Kong adaptations. You know, obviously this was not official stuff, but what's funny to me is that, you know, in 1993, a Jackie Chan movie, which was a licensed adaptation of a Japanese property, but it was, you know, City Hunter, the manga, the anime about the sort of private detective guy. But in that movie, they go to an arcade and Jackie Chan gets electrocuted by, you know, he gets thrown into an arcade machine, and that changes the entire movie for a scene where everyone becomes Street Fighter characters.
It is so weird. Like Jackie Chan in Chun-Li's outfit is just like so deeply surreal.
It's perfect.
And the sound effects are straight out of the arcade machine, because I think it was like obviously not a licensed product, so they literally had somebody audio taping it off of the arcade, and it was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious.
And the speed is all jacked up, so like when characters like emote or when he does Chun-Li's like poses, like they look more authentic to the game's speed or something. It's bizarre.
It was so weird.
But you can tell because it's, you know, because 1993, there, you know, there is no, you know, special effects or whatever we can do physically. So when you've got these actors doing all the spin kicks, and there's a guy who's playing Ken, and Jackie becomes Chun-Li. So the two of them start doing spin kicks at each other. So these two actors are, you know, physically rotating as they're being pushed and pulled towards each other inside of this set. You know, I can't imagine that how long that must have taken to shoot. And, you know, they must have gotten dizzy at some point, because that's just physically demanding to be up, you know, at least, especially in Jackie's case, because he's going to be upside down.
Put him on a turntable and just spin it while he's out there. But it, I mean, it looked cool. It looked really cool. And I know that, like, when back then when it came out, a lot of us were passing, you know, tapes around, and everybody had that tape of, like, the scene where he gets sucked into the arcade and is fun playing Street Fighter, because everybody's like, what in the hell is going on? And we only had, like, weird Hong Kong dubs of this stuff, so nobody had ever seen the actual movie, but it was just super weird. And he's got lipstick on. He's really committing to the Chun-Li bit. It's phenomenal. And I don't know what Capcom thought of it, but I know everybody, it's like legendary now, right? The scene is just super weird. I need to go back and actually watch that movie fully now.
Well, no one must have sent any angry letters, because a mere 6 months later, there's another movie called Future Cops, which is the same director, I believe Wong Jing, same director. And that is, it's a different story entirely, but there are lots of characters who are just straight up taken from Street Fighter II in that movie. just with, you know, the slightest of name changes, like Guile is Broomhead, you know, like there's an angry boxer. There's a, you know, the evil, there's an evil dictator. Like almost all of your favorites are here. They're just not called what you expected.
Broomhead.
And it's a but it's a science fiction sort of, you know, epic.
Okay. So I need to interrupt you for a second. I'm sorry, but yes. I went back and I found an image of the guy playing Ken doing the hurricane kick. And he's literally standing there with his leg out in the kick pose, but he's being spun artificially. You can, like, you could tell that he's like on top of something that is being spun, and he has to just hold that pose. And it looks so deeply painful for him to be doing the tatsumaki like that. But, you know, go figure.
Well, it's funny, Shivam, as you mentioned before, you know, in that first animated film, you know, the one that we actually made in Japan.
Yes.
They went to great lengths to sort of not, you know, it's not realistic, but they tried to make the idea of a human spinning kick looked like it mattered.
Right.
And every comic, the US cartoon, and, you know, these Hong Kong movies, like, they all went in very different directions, and none of them, you know, in the case of the Hong Kong movie, at least I think they're trying to be funny. But in the US cartoon and the US comic book, it just looks weird, you know?
I think they just didn't really understand or try to get the conceit of what it means to do these fireballs and stuff. Because the thing about Street Fighter and these moves, obviously they're taking from the manga tradition, they're taking from Chinese wuxia type of, like, movies and action. Like, calling out your move while you're doing it is very much out of the wuxia tradition. It's like a very kung fu thing to do. It's like, I'm going to do the seven tiger strike or whatever. And if you don't have that background, you don't understand necessarily why these things are being done, then it seems like, okay, well, they're just weird. They're yelling out their move and then spinning. I don't get it. But at least the Japanese art, the Japanese anime, at least tried to contextualize it within that understanding that by yelling this thing, channeling my ki, I can shoot a fireball, and it makes sense in context.
Mm. So in that sense, it's almost like the Hong Kong movies are sort of taking it back.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm sure some of those guys have played monks in wuxia movies too, so it works.
So, live action, we should at least address the fact that, yes, in 1994, the same year as the animated film, we did in fact get a Hollywood production, a big budget live action film starring, you know, the man, the myth, the Belgian, Jean-Claude Van Damme, as Colonel William Guile. This was released for Christmas in 1994. I remember I went to see this on Christmas Day. As a Jewish person, you know, Christmas Day is usually, I go to the movies because nothing else is open. So I saw this film on Christmas Day, 1994, and gotta say, a little disappointing. Little disappointing for me at the time as a teenager.
I mean, for me, it was Tuesday, so
one of us was gonna get it in there at some point,
dude.
Listen.
Yes,
this movie was not good at the time. You watch this movie now, and
it's still not good.
It's still not good. You'll have 1,000% more fun than almost every other video game movie ever made. Like, watch this over the Assassin's Creed or the Warcraft movie or the second Silent Hill movie or the second Mortal Kombat. You know what I mean? Like,
hey, Prince of Persia was actually a really good adaptation. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, that was solid. I mean, even the first Silent Hill movie, you can make an argument for that. But at the time, being like a huge Street Fighter fan and watching this, you're just aghast. You're speechless. You have no idea.
I'm sorry. The second that E. Honda walked out of the back of the truck as the newsroom camera guy, and I'm like, what in the hell are you doing? What is this?
And like, Chun-Li's a reporter, and all everyone's job is mixed up. Everyone just took a random job from the job hat. Oh yeah, DJ's a computer hacker. I'm not sure if you have this written, but I do know a little bit about this production in the sense that they had to get Capcom USA executives before they left Japan because they tried pitching this all over Hollywood. No one could give them something they wanted. And they decreed you have to have every single character from Super Street Fighter 2 in this. Like, that is one of our mandates. So they struggled to, every movie company was like, how about this? How about that? Like, no. Someone told the director, Steven D'Souza, who has made actually quite a few like notable movies as a writer.
Yes. He had a whole career. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he worked on Die Hard and a bunch of Schwarzenegger movies. And he was told, you have to get something ready over the weekend. Like, you have to get a story treatment done in before like Tuesday out of all days. And just threw this together, just said, how can I get a bunch of characters like in a movie? Like, you create two warring factions, right? So that's why I took that G.I. Joe style like thing and just, where can I shove in all the characters? Bah, 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 bah. I'm done. Send it. We have to film it before Christmas. Like, this movie got filmed, edited during the summer and was out by Christmas. Like, considering, let's be fair, considering all those things, it's a miracle it's as entertaining as it is, as bad and as cheesy as it is.
To be fair, D'Souza had quite an active 1994. He put out both The Flintstones, Beverly Hills Cop 3, and Street Fighter.
Wow, worker.
And that was right before Judge Dredd in 1995. So this man has definitely put in his effort.
But his magnum opus.
Kylie Minogue as Cammy.
She's probably one of the best like actual adaptations of the characters. She looks the part and she does a couple of her moves. She even says thrust kick, which I still can't believe someone actually said a move, because no one does.
Dude, all I know is that they turned Dalsim into a scientist with hair. And what blew my mind is the actor who played Dalsim, Roshan Seth, he is one of the great British Indian actors. He was freaking Jawaharlal Nehru in Gandhi, like literal Academy Award winning genius actor. And they stick him as Dalsim in this goddamn wreck of a movie. And I'm like,
the role of a lifetime.
Like, wow, man, you went from like literally one of the greatest roles in cinema and then just, what?
Well, speaking of one of the greatest roles in cinema, we have Raul Julia as M. Bison.
Oh my, right. I mean, like, look, fans, we've done an episode on this show fully in 2012. You should go look it up because that's like two full hours of like this movie. And because I don't want to get too deep into it, because we can go deep into like, because the making of this movie is incredible. All
it's
the stories,
all right. It's been 9 years. We can address some topics.
Yeah,
again,
I mean, but the fact that Raul Julia's last movie just hurts my soul.
Yeah, that's true.
It just it hits me right here. Like, what?
I believe he passed away in between, like before it was released. Because by the time it was released, there was a dedication to him.
Yeah,
like, I remember seeing that on screen. I think it said "Vaya con Dios."
Yeah,
there's a post credit scene in this movie that predates Marvel by decades, where they imply that Bison's fine. He didn't even die. It's amazing. They knew they were going to make sequels and sequels and sequels for years.
Boy, did they think that.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned the G.I. Joe thing, which we should actually mention. There were, in fact, Hasbro produced actual action figures for Street Fighter, and they're very much literally branded as G.I. Joe characters with vehicles and guns and like backpacks and all this. Like, they went full on. So it makes sense that, you know, by the time they made a live action movie, like, okay, well, it's, and even in the cartoon, they seem to stick with the idea of, well, we've got good guy army and bad guy army.
Yeah, because it was like a formula that worked for like kids, like for G.I. Joe, and even like to a lesser extent, like He-Man, you know, lots of shows. So I don't, And when you say that there is a criminal organization, like the game almost sets it up like, oh, there it's Shadaloo. Now Shadaloo's the name of an organization. And in these adaptations, it becomes like a country, like Madeupistan. It's just somewhere in the world. Shadaloo is, and I'm still surprised that they called it Shadaloo. I don't know why the dub of the animated movie called it Shadow Law. Still so
well,
weird.
I mean, because in the early 90s version of the translations, it was in American localization, it was Shadaloo and Shadow Law kind of interchangeably for a while before they really settled on Shadaloo.
Yeah, I was never sure which one was correct. I just assumed that, you know, someone made their best guess. I always thought Shadaloo was the wrong one because, like, what the hell is a Shadaloo? Yeah. But eventually that is proven to be the canon answer. So,
yeah, like,
you know, Teenage Diamond.
In the original Street Fighter II, like, arcade release in the US, it was Shadow Law. And then I think eventually they just picked one and went with it. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad they did that because, you know, it did mean that many, many years later when they made The Legend of Chun-Li, you get to have what's his name? The Boy, American Pie Kid say Shadaloo so many times straight into the camera.
Oh, my God, dude.
Yeah, what's this? Klein something?
Yeah, Chris Klein, yes.
Chris Klein plays Nash. Like, I could talk about Legend of Chun-Li, but I won't. What I will say, it's like, that's an actual dreadful movie that, like, saps, like, happiness out of people.
Hang on.
Like, there's nothing there.
So I was working at IGN or a PlayStation Magazine or something. Let's see, when did this come out? 2009? I was at, like, PlayStation Magazine when this came out. And I remember going from the office to go see this movie. And it was literally, like, me and, like, four other people from the office were the only people in the theater. Because, you know, we're a game magazine. We have to go and watch the Chun-Li movie. Oh, wow. Was this definitely, next to the Dragon Ball live-action American version, this might be one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. And it's just like Kristen Kreuk, the girl who played Chun-Li, was just awful and wooden, and she was a piano player and just like all these things, and it was so weird. It was so weird, and it's just so unrelated to literally anything at all.
And it's just, it's like one of those things where we need to make a gritty reboot where everything's more grounded. We need to make like the Batman Begins of Street Fighter. So now Bison's just a real estate mogul in a suit.
And I mean, then there was like the Black Eyed Peas guy as Vega, which was weird. And I was like,
so weird. And the guy that played Liu Kang in Mortal Kombat plays Gen.
It's just, yeah.
He's not that old.
Yeah, they gave him like an old wig and that's it. Like, he didn't even age like poorly at all. And they're just like, yeah, he's Gen now. I'm like, what the hell?
Oh my God, dude. That dude, Chris Klein playing Nash, was just awful. Off. I mean, this. Okay, you know what? I don't want to talk about this movie. It makes me mad.
Yeah, I do want to share two things though. My favorite thing about the movie is the fact that I think it's still online. If you look up, someone has made a supercut of every line Chris Klein says in the movie, and it really accentuates how sort of just lifeless his performance is. Like, yeah, like I think the review I read that like said that, you know, sometimes if an actor can't even convince you when he walks into a room, that's telling. Like every line he says is, no, I don't believe you. I don't believe you at all.
But it's almost, it's treading that so bad it's good, like, thing that it's at, like, Kristen that plays Chun-Li, like, she's actually just kind of wooden and she doesn't really have much to do. But Chris Klein is almost, he could be in The Room. Like, he could have been casted in that somewhere, you know, like, it's almost there. But everyone else is so forgettable. Even the guy, Neil McDonough, who's been in a lot of movies over the years, like,
sure,
a million roles, he's usually quite good. And here, like, he kind of hams it up, but you can't compare to the role Julia Bison. So they try to do something different, but it doesn't really do anything. Like, he's not intimidating in the least.
I should also mention, much to my surprise, they actually have a different cut of this movie in Japan where they swap out the names. So they say Vega, not Bison.
Wow.
Which, like, I just can't imagine how much that must have cost money. Like, that's
somebody spent time doing that.
Yeah, and that's unique. You know, I don't think the 94 movie did that. I doubt any other property did that. But for this movie, you know, this total failure of a movie, they actually took the time, and, you know, so there's a cutout there of Chris Klein saying Vega, 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 you know? I just
Okay, I need to read Leonard Maltin's. So the film critic Leonard Maltin wrote one of my favorite lines about this movie, which is, the 1994 picture was one of the worst movies ever inspired by a video game. Even Jean-Claude Van Damme fans couldn't rationalize this turkey, which should have been titled 400 Funerals and No Sex. Yet, this pointless and inept action vehicle makes its predecessor seem like Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes. Hopelessly contrived with lamely choreographed fight scenes, the highlight is Chris Klein's cry of, "Bomb! Get out now!" Our sentiments exactly.
Bam! Got him! Nailed it, Leonard Maltin.
The hottest trash. It was so bad. Like, this is the bad that's not even a good rewatch when you're drunk bad.
Yeah.
This is the bad bad.
The 94 film, I think, is long overdue for me revisiting it. You know, now that
it's
I'm not
fun. It's fun.
A pissy teenager, but I have no interest in seeing anything outside of, you know, the supercut of Chris Klein for this movie.
So that happened.
Did it?
Unfortunately.
It's real. It's real. You can buy it. You can buy that movie if you want to buy it. So we should probably move on to one more item that I had listed here, which is a game, but it's not a Street Fighter game. It's a Street Fighter storytelling game. It was released in 1994 by White Wolf. Yes, the people who brought you Vampire and Werewolf, those games. They made an official Street Fighter, you know, officially called Street Fighter, the storytelling game. And, you know, I put this in here as sort of, oh, this was real. I never heard about this. But Shivam, you said you have this game?
Yeah, because I'm a Street Fighter nerd and a tabletop nerd. And I was like, there's a Street Fighter tabletop game? Okay, I need to. Okay, so first off, I need to say that when I was a kid, I used to play a lot of RPGs in my school, and we used to play Rifts is this kind of big, like, heavy game. If you imagine, like, kind of Guyver or Gundam or, like, just super big explodey things. And one of the things is I tried to make Ryu as a character. And everybody else is sitting here with, like, giant, like, mecha and, like, things. And I'm just, like, a little human shooting fireballs once in a while. It did not work well to my favor. So when I saw that White Wolf actually had put out their own Street Fighter game, I was intrigued because Vampire is a fantastic setting. Whether you like it or not, it's one of the most well-developed rule sets in tabletop RPGs. And so if anybody's going to do this, I figured, okay, let's see what an actual Street Fighter RPG would be like. It turns out it was actually really, really good. Like, this game didn't go anywhere, but it definitely had a lot of, like, it had a couple of expansions, but I think the crossover between Street Fighter fans and RPG fans is, like, limited to me and maybe 20 other people. Because, like, if you're fighting in the streets, you're not really throwing the dice in the sheets, is what I'm saying. But the thing is, though, they used basically a modified version of the Vampire rule set with you could have, like, dots of different skills that you could, like, buy, and you had a point buy system that you could use to build up your thing. And you had all these cool skills like perception. I mean, perception everywhere, but, like, you know, intimidation or streetwise or blind fighting and, like, how good you are in an arena and all of these other things. There were a whole bunch of, like, rules on different kung fu styles, on different fighting styles, even, like, you know, Dalsim's weird usage of kabaddi. Now, this thing has always bugged me. Kabaddi is not a fighting system. India's got plenty of martial arts. Kabaddi is like a sport. It's like if you ever played the kindergarten game Red Rover, mm-hmm. That is literally what kabaddi is, where there's two lines of people on either side trying to run at each other and break through the line. That's not a very good, like, kung fu, right? Like, this is good for kindergartens, not for fighting. But they had basically this whole kind of, like, they found every sort of pseudo-human, like, fighting system in the world that you could use to apply to these Street Fighters what they're doing, and they made them into rule sets. And it was really, really cool. It was a really, really neat way to actually tell to make a story about, like, being a Street Fighter. What is it like to be able to RPG your way through when you can also shoot fireballs and, like, you know, do hurricane kicks and stretch your arms and stuff? And they realized, like, okay, kind of the gimmick here is that you're a Street Fighter, you want to be doing street fights. So a lot of the story kind of plot is about arena battles, about one-on-one fights with other like, you know, Street Fighter type characters about leveling up your things to be good in these types of arena fights. You could also use this system because it's an RPG. You could tell any kind of story you want if you wanted to redo the Street Fighter animated movie and go cop hunting and stuff. But it was cool. It was one of the better fight systems I've seen. It was a lot of fun. And I think that, like, this game is one of those games that's like 20 years late. It's probably cool for a redo. Like, it was balanced well. It had good stats. I mean, it's cool. I just really respect it. I liked it a lot. And I never found anybody, like, after that first time to play it with. Because it's just like, everyone's like, ah, we could be playing Street Fighter, or I could be playing anything else. Like, we could be fighting about Beholders instead. But no, it's cool. There's still, like, kind of a fan community out there that still plays this game. It was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
So I looked this up and I found a 2017 piece on Vice about this game where they interviewed some of the people behind it. And I got this interesting quote from Steve Wick, who was, you know, apparently a major force at White Wolf at the time. And he talked about what input they had because it was licensed. So they had to talk to Capcom of, like, you know, who are these characters? And the quote is Capcom just basically gave them a bunch of sort of like outlines where it's like, don't change any of the main characters. There should never be a situation where they die. And when it comes to Shadowloo or in any parts of the setting, they basically said, well, we don't know. So we'd write things and have them approve it. And they more or less said, sure, to what we'd done. So that's why I guess they were allowed to sort of incorporate like other kinds of fighting styles and even sort of things that were, you know, a little weird, you know, compared to Street Fighter. But honestly, Street Fighter itself, like Street Fighter 2, at least, is already full of weird stuff. So I guess it's kind of hard to out weird Street Fighter as it is.
Right. Yeah. Like for instance, they had really good grapple rules and stuff. Cause I mean, when you think about it, a lot of Street Fighter is close combat. It's about running up and doing combos. It's about doing fireballs. It's about grabbing people and throwing them, and trying to get that in tabletop is very difficult. So you have to do things like you had like basically combat cards, which had different maneuvers on them and different moves. And you would try to use them kind of in chain and combos in order to be able to link your things together. For instance, in the rule book here, like if you're trying to do here's one of their examples of play, right? So Hugo and Jade square off. They're 8 hexes apart because it's a tabletop role-playing game. The round begins and Jade attempts a spinning knuckle punch while Hugo plays a block. They go, they compare their speeds. Whoever speed is faster is the one that hits. And then because of her spinning knuckle punch, she moves forward 6 hexes, but is still far enough away so she can't actually hit him, and so on and so forth. And it's like, it's a very good way to take an abstract fighting of this, like I'm running at you and punching, and turning it into something you can put numbers on that would actually let you play a game. And it basically felt a lot like one-on-one D&D combat where you got your in second edition where you had like speed initiative. And so like, you know, Hugo's got a lower speed. So he goes first, he tries to do a roundhouse kick to close the distance, et cetera, et cetera. It's great. It's really, really fun. Like it reads weird and it's hard to actually like try to wrap your head around when you're looking at it. But if you get into it, it's rad. Like I loved it. I thought it was super cool.
Sounds phenomenal, and it sounds like it's too bad that because its nature is a licensed work, they probably can't even reprint it even if they want.
Oh yeah, no, but you can get the full PDF of the rules online very easily. Nobody's going to stop you because Capcom doesn't care and White Wolf doesn't care. So it's worth your time if you care about like historic RPGs. It is a 1994 system, so it's not modern in any way, shape, or form. But if you've ever played a vampire or werewolf or any of the kind of White Wolf system games, you will easily understand how to play this game. It's super quick to pick up and it's complicated and gets a little nuts and boltsy, but it's Street Fighter. It's fine. You'll get it. It's been a long and winding road. Got a love at breaking people's bones. It's supernatural. You don't want to be alone. Once there were enemies, now friends. Take nothing to realize your kin. Straight up or cut. Well, before we wrap up today, I did want to find if anyone else had any other item they wanted to share that's not the game Street Fighter 2, but related to Street Fighter 2, as far as media or fan works. Yes, yes, yes.
Please.
Okay, so you guys all know about OC Remix. OC Remix, of course, being the website online since like the early 2000s, where fans can go and upload their own versions of video game music. So one of my favorite songs of all time, real music or not real music, just in general music, is this thing called The Ken Song. The Ken Song by JD Project, which is basically taking the Ken theme from Street Fighter II and then putting lyrics to it. And it is fantastic. It is so, like, first off, he does an absolutely beautiful job of just playing the song of, like, musically, like, the guy's got a ton of talent. He builds up guitar textures. He's got great drum work. And then he does lyrics about this. And it's just, like, they're so cheesy and, like, earnest that by the end of it, even, like, you want to make the anime pose where your fist is in the air, tears are streaming down your face, and you're like, I want to realize my Ken, too! And it's so good. It's so good. It, like, it fills me. It's like one of those songs where when I'm down and sad, I fire this song up, and it just fills me with happiness and life again. It's, like, super hair metal, super joyful, and it is one of the greatest fan works of Street Fighter ever, honest to God. Like, it's just super good.
Lyrically speaking, where is it coming from? Is it someone singing about Ken, or is it Ken about Ken, or how does it work?
It's a song from, like, the standpoint of Ken and about trying to fight, and like the chorus line is like, oh, Eliza, help me, you know, like, give me your strength so that I can go through and fight this. It's definitely like Ken has just had the crap kicked out of him. He's trying to get up and trying to, like, realize his inner strength
and just wake up Dragon Punch.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's one of those things where you're just like, you listen, you're like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then 38 listens later, you're like, I love this. I love it so much. It's seriously one of my favorite things ever.
There's one other project that I did want to speak about really briefly, more of an anecdote on it. There are a few other animated, like, things that came out based on Street Fighter. There was Street Fighter Alpha, the animated movie, which was had a lot of, like, made-up OCs that kind of show up. Bison's not even in it. Then there's the Street Fighter IV animated movie, The Ties That Bind. That was, like, in a special edition of Super Street Fighter IV, I believe. But the one I wanted to mention is Street Fighter Alpha Generations, which was a very different take on the source material, which went for a really, like, gritty sort of realistic style, or, like, not realistic, but, like, very odd character designs. And it tells all about Akuma becoming, like, you know, the demon he everyone knows in the game. So he's a regular guy, and you're watching this and thinking, who asked for this? And he's like doing chores and talking to these really basic, like, almost non-existent woman character. I don't even remember her name. And it's a short film. It's something like 40 minutes. Like, it's barely, like, it's an OVA for all intents and purposes. And the reason why I bring it up is because I think at one of the earlier Evos, I want to say like 2006, maybe, a representative from Manga Entertainment who produced this is showing it in a special viewing. So you see, you have a sea of really hardcore Street Fighter fans watching this really poor adaptation of Street Fighter, and it did not go well.
Oh, no.
I've read multiple accounts of this. I was not there myself, but heckling, like Mystery Science Theater levels of heckling at this as it was going on, and apparently the representative from Manga Entertainment walked out at some point because he was fed up of the crowd's reaction, people, like, you know, hooting and hollering at all the wrong times, making lewd jokes, and everyone just taking this as, like, you know, what it was, which is a really silly adaptation of the source material that didn't, you know, like, Ken and Ryu appear for like 1 second towards the end. Wait, I'm not even sure if Ryu's in it. I don't care. I think Ryu's in it. It's probably, of the animated things, it's probably the worst one. Like, I would much rather, and I would suggest people, like, watch the animated cartoon series or Street Fighter 2V compared to this, because it's kind of a downer. There's no, you know, when I think of Street Fighter, I think of, like, it's a fun martial arts tournament. There's some evil characters for sure, but this is just like this, I don't know, boring and inspired, sort of like dark take on the source material, and it's not a good time. I'm not even sure if it's been re-released since its original release. I have to assume maybe it did, maybe like in a two-pack or something with Street Fighter Alpha, and which is a much better film. But I just wanted to get that in there because it's such an oddity in the like animated adaptations.
Well, the one project I wanted to mention, even though it is not retro, gasp, about eight years ago, I'm not sure the exact date, maybe 2014, there was a album released here in Japan called Street Fighter Remix Chiptune, Chiptune being two word. And it's since released on streaming media, so I think it's pretty easy to find at this point. And it's a remix album of music from Street Fighter II, the original 12 tracks. And each song is by a different artist. And there's really not any really singing, but there is lots of game audio in this music. And each song has a very different style to it. Like one of them is even though the album is called Chiptune, I would say only one of them is really like chiptune, whereas the rest of them is just like this electronic stuff. I would say one of them kind of sounds like a little bit of a dubstep a little bit. But each of these tracks I think is very different and really enjoy. I think it's a really enjoyable album from just overall.
It was a very cool disc.
Yeah, the artwork is exceptional because the artwork has like it's all the original portraits, but they've all been modified to like have like headphones on or a turntable or something. Like it's really cleverly marketed. Like it's something that I saw in a store. I was like, oh, I have to have this. I bought it sight unseen, and it's an album I listen to a lot. It's really worth checking out if you haven't heard it yet. So yeah, the only thing for me is the only one I can't stand is the Blanca song, because the Blanca song is just a weird din. Because it's like they have a beat, but then it just goes off in weird directions, and I don't know. It's not for me. My personal favorite is the Boxer song, because it just sounds like it's kind of Vegas-y. I like it.
Hmm.
But on that note, I feel like we've been talking for a good 90 minutes.
My goodness.
I feel like we've supplemented our Street Fighters. We did it, you know? Victory is ours. So let's wrap up the show, and let's start with Shivam. Please, why don't you tell people about you?
You can find me at Electrotal or Gearpuri Gears. You can find me on a podcast that I put out every week called Casual Magic. It's an interview podcast based around Magic the Gathering. It comes out every Tuesday. And otherwise, you can hear me on like half a dozen different Retronauts episodes, because Jeremy calls me whenever he's like, hey, Shivam, there's a game that you love and we'll talk about for like 3 years. So like he had me on a double episode talking about Magic the Gathering and Civilization, which is literally my two favorite things on the planet. And it was just basically, if you've ever wanted to hear me lecture for like 2.5 hours while Parrish just sits there and tries to hold on, I recommend you check out that episode of Retronauts.
Thank you very much for your extended enthusiasm. We really appreciate it. Mr. McMuscles, if that is your real name.
It is. It's not, actually. you can find me at Matt McMuscles on YouTube, where I do my series What Happened, which I've covered a couple of the things you talked about today, like the Street Fighter the movie, the game, and I'll also dive into Street Fighter the animated series as well, and I give that a watch along, where I've consumed beverages of a certain type while I watch that show, because that's the only way you can possibly watch it. But you can find me there or on Twitter, also at Matt McMuscles.
I really appreciate your What Happened series, because, you know, rather than just, you know, I think you instead of doing the YouTube thing where you watch something like, boy, doesn't this suck? This sucks. You actually talk about, you know, production mistakes. And in some cases, you almost explain like, you know what, this is bad because this happened and that's why it's bad. And I really... going the extra mile, I think, makes a big difference. Thank you.
Doing quality assurance for games for 7 years is kind of what honed that in on me, saying like there's always a million reasons why games and certain projects wind up the way they do.
Yes. Everything has a reason. Even Mortal Kombat Annihilation has a reason.
It does.
As for us, this is Retronauts. Thank you very much for listening to Retronauts. We have new episodes every Monday. If you are a patron, a $3 patron, you get the episodes 1 week early. If you are a $5 patron, you get bonus episodes. We have two bonus episodes every month. You also have a weekly column from me. I write the column and then I read it to you if you'd like me to read it to you. $5 also gives you Discord access to our Retronauts Discord. Thank you very much for joining us in that regards. As for me personally, Diamond Fight, you can find me on Twitter and Twitch as Fight Club, F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B, the regular English word. And I also have my own Patreon and Ko-Fi, but I didn't say it, did I? No, patreon.com/retronauts is how you support the show and get those bonuses that I already mentioned.
Isn't that coffee?
Is it Ko-Fi or Ko-Fi?
It's coffee, because they're like, hey, buy me a coffee. Like, you're buying me a tip. And then it became coffee, K-O-F-I.
I always thought it was Ko-Fi, but then again, I don't know.
It's me living in Japan. I see K-O-F-I. I'm going to say it's Ko-Fi.
Kohi o nonde kudasai. And if you're a $50 patron of Retronauts, you can actually listen to the show before we record it.
It's true. The Time Warp Edition. All right, that's out. Any last words, any screams we want to scream out?
It takes nothing to realize you're Ken. That's all I'm going to say. Go and listen to Ochi Remix. Trust me, it is worth your life.
Good night.